You're listening to The Move with Jared Dattis and Michael Ray, conversations exploring why healthcare real estate is moving from alternative to essential, and how smart capital is making the shift to one of the most overlooked asset classes today.
Morning, Mike.
Morning, JD.
How you doing?
I'm great. How are you?
Great. Yeah. You work out today?
The day that ends in Y.
And today's workout was what?
Today, leg day.
Leg day.
Yes.
Creatine?
10 grams.
10?
Yeah. Almost a little snafu. They almost ran out of weight for me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You're lifting so that much weight?
Yeah. Almost had to send the PA to get some more, but, that's a good leg day.
Okay. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
That. We're going to have to talk about the creatine sometime, but not today.
Why?
Because I have a more interesting topic for us to talk about.
I love it. What are we talking about today,
then? So I want to talk about senior housing and senior living and what this means to an investor as it relates to the overall healthcare business. As we've been talking, we have the medical side of the business, seniors,
right,
and we have science. And so I think it's a wonderful opportunity to get into that conversation. And we
love
have
it.
A guest today.
It's my favorite opportunity.
I know it is. So introduce our guest.
Yeah, no. So we're fortunate to have with us today our president of Experience Senior Living, our wholly owned operator of NextCore. Phil is an industry veteran that frankly has given new meaning to the term age in place. Phil's a lifer in the industry, having started in the senior living business as a teenager and sort of working his way through. But Phil, I've done enough to say, how about you introduce yourself?
Yeah. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Jared. Glad to be here. Really excited about this. As you mentioned, I'm Phil Barkla. I'm the president of Experience Senior Living. This is my 32nd year in senior housing. So I'm I am very much a lifer.
He's only 35.
That's exactly right. Yes. But as you mentioned, I did start in the communities, working in the communities and as a frontline employee, working really every position in the building. I started as a dishwasher and a weekend receptionist at the front desk, or concierge, as we like to call them, and then worked in the care department and in food service and sales and marketing before I became an executive director, and kind of my career worked more to the ZAP side from there.
Yeah, so. No, I love it. And Phil joining us was a very intentional exercise, by NextCore when we made that very, again, intentional decision to create a vertically integrated operator. But, JD, I think that's an important place for us to start, because as we have described over the course of these conversations, NextCore as a company really began as a medical developer.
Right,
and obviously the fundamentals behind that and the focus on that and the need to have deep domain expertise and relationships, but the transition, the natural transition and move into senior living, which may not necessarily be intuitive, but nevertheless, I think, the backstory about how, we got into the space may help sort of inform kind of the broader discussion we're going to have today. So why don't
sure.
you give a little background on
sure,
that?
Sure. And you and I talked about this before. I mean, a little bit of it's personal, and then we can talk about the professional, and won't spend too much time on the personal side. But as I mentioned to you, when my grandfather had Alzheimer's, I felt like he was locked away. And it was an old facility, and it's just, for me personally, it's just not where a person could go to thrive and live. Whether or not they had dementia or they were in independent living. From a business perspective, I think we find ourselves here today because of a couple of different reasons. First, and this is where the synergy with an investor has really been important to us. One of our very important investors had helped us really launch this business. And at the same time, we were getting information from some of our healthcare clients about this need. Many of the healthcare systems and physician providers saw the need as well, but it wasn't their core expertise. And because of relationships that we had built, assets that we were developing, investment opportunities that we were creating, it seemed to be a natural. And so 10 years ago, roughly 10 years ago at this point,
2015,
we kicked off that business. And we'll get into a little bit of the conversation because I'd like to get Phil's perspective from an operations perspective. But what we did then is not what we're doing now. And there's a reason why. And when we were looking at the business back then, we didn't have the insight into the data that we do now as well. So I think we should touch base on the data too, because I think it's relevant for our investors that could be listening today.
Yeah. So. Yeah. No, and it's right. And you know, we've spoken to the supply gap, the extreme supply gap, the fact that we need to be building 40,000 units or starting 40,000 units a year, but we're managing, you know, less than 10% of that.
Correct.
So we have this massive supply gap. We've talked about, you know, the sort of relative functional obsolescence of the existing supply. So that's further exacerbating that supply component. But more importantly, we've also touched on how this demographic, right, the boomers in particular, as they age into this space, they're bringing with them a consumer-focused mindset and expectation about what that end user experience should be.
Yep.
And so we've kind of covered, you know, on the development side, how we're looking at that in terms of the design and the physical footprint of these communities. We had a great conversation with Christoph on how, you know, he approaches the fundamental needs Absolutely. Of humanity and how they move around. I mean, it was just sort of like could have gone on for days,
yes,
right?
Yes.
But what we haven't yet touched on is the fact that as that consumer mindset and the end user expectation evolves, as the physical environment changes to adapt and facilitate those outcomes, it puts the spotlight or at least emphasizes, okay, how, if at all, is the operational aspect of the business evolving? Because yeah. one can naturally conclude that if those fundamental things are changing, so too must the ops.
Yeah.
And as you know, Phil, one of the, if not the first questions that we are faced with when we're interfacing with capital around investment and capital allocation to seniors is it an ops business? Is it a real estate business? Right. Is it something else?
Right.
What say you?
Yeah, great question. It's both. And that's the beauty of it. And you touched on so many different things that are so critical. So I think that it is an operating business and it's a real estate business. And that's the beauty of how this gets de-risked, in my opinion. So if it was just an operating business, I could understand investors concerned about that. If it was just a real estate business, I could understand the concern about that. But I look back to, you know, kind of my experience through the GFC and what was happening in 2008. Real estate was not a great investment during that time. But if you look at seniors housing, it performed quite well,
right.
staying operationally kind of flat occupancy wise and actually having increases in rates kind of across the board. But that's kind of macro. But if you look at the micro data in really good markets where real estate is good, it did perform better. It actually had increases in occupancy and significant increases in rates during the GFC. And we're kind of seeing that's the same thing today. So, mm-hmm. so to me, when the real estate does well, that's great. You can overcome poor real estate with great operations, and you can overcome poor operations with great real estate. But when you get the two together, that's really what we're looking for. And that's what's really, really special to me.
I think that's spot on. And so when we started the business, as you know, in 2015, that approach, that philosophy was top of mind, mm-hmm. but the execution and how we went about it was slightly different
yes.
because at that time we didn't have operations internal to NextCore.
Yes.
And we did different ventures with some really great companies. But I think what we found, and it became obvious, especially going through the difficult times of COVID, was in that joint venture arrangement, you didn't really have one point of responsibility. Mm-hmm. So from an investor perspective, I think it was helpful that we formed ESL so that our investors could rely on one point. I distinctly remember walking through an airport when we were meeting with one of our joint venture partners. Again, wonderful people, but it hit us. And I remember a conversation we had with their ownership group. And it was just one of those things that I felt like we were a blended family. Mm-hmm. They just didn't love our kids as much as they love
yes.
their own kids,
yes.
right? And because they had their own assets and they had a lot of upside in those assets, different than the deals that we had done. And so speak to a little bit more about the sole point of responsibility and how that does benefit an investor. Because I do think, and we're starting to see this as well with some of our execution, just going from conception of a project through a full monetization of a project,
yes.
that when we align the development and the capital and the operations with a focus on taking care of our residents, taking care of our team members and being in the right markets and right locations. That seems to be a win.
Yes.
I may be biased. So,
well, I am as well, right? Okay, so good. I don't think it's wrong to be biased, but it's biased through experience, right? Mm-hmm. So I think you hit the nail on the head when you said alignment. That's the key word to this, and that vertical integration and alignment between capital, owner, operator, developer. That's just so much synergy that comes out. And to be fair to the other operators that we've had in the past, there's a difference between being a fee operator, which is really just based off of your revenue, and being an owner and having true skin in the game and guarantees, right? That really makes a huge difference. So I've been on the side of just a fee operator, of having multiple different owners and developers. And, you know, it's just human nature to say, well, where's my capital, you know, the most risked, right? Sure. And so it's not risk if you're just a fee operator.
No, you finish.
I just think, to me, to have that vertical integration, that complete alignment, just aligns everything. And if I was an investor, that's what I'd be focused on.
Yes. Two buzzwords that have come through that I think form the essence of the conversation, right? And you guys just spoke to alignment, but Phil mentioned it, you know, when you sort of, you know, led your answer. And I love that too, because it is a dual exercise around alignment, but also risk mitigation.
Of course.
Right. And you know, taking that sort of, you know, fairly wide window of risk and doing everything you possibly can to sort of mitigate that. We talk about it in the context of controlling the things that you can control.
Right.
Right. So when you have control in the context of the development, the creation of the physical space, and then you have the control with respect to the influence and over the operations, you seek, to your earlier point, you significantly de-risk that while facilitating and enabling that alignment. So yeah. I think those two things married together,
right,
substantially increase the probability of an optimal outcome.
Well, you also, as an operator, think like an owner.
Yes.
Which is different because you are an owner, right? So when I look at the CapEx list or when I'm walking through a building and seeing what's important to the residents, I'm thinking like an owner. How are we investing in this project long term to make sure that we don't have issues, you know, 2 years down the road, 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, because we want to continue to own and operate these communities in perpetuity.
Yeah, no, 100%. And so I think that's a great sort of baseline explanation of the philosophical approach to sort of operations and how, you know, that informs the mindset. So let's shift to, you know, something more tactical,
sure,
if you will. You know, as we were discussing, you know, the supply gap, right? And sort of how that then also translates into the challenges created by, you know, the existing inventory,
yes,
you know, being, you know, in its vintage and things like that, you know, effectively, creating an environment where it's a fairly, you know, commoditized, prototypical type product, right? Mm-hmm. We can all close our eyes and imagine what senior living looks like, feels like, and smells like.
Sure,
right?
Sure. Unfortunately, yes.
And so as a result of that, you know, one of the places where we see real opportunity is to facilitate choice.
Yes.
And just create alternatives, both, you know, in the physical format, but then also on how that experience is realized by the user. So from a tactical perspective, how do you translate that philosophical approach, that ownership mindset, yes, to how you operate these communities?
Well, great question. And I think when I think of choice, or I think of the boomers, I think of their desire to have control and choice over their life and their lifestyle. And I think that that's really what's driven our multi-brand approach. I want to go back to something you said in the initial question, because I think it's pertinent to this discussion, is the consumer has changed. And I just don't look at that as the resident themselves.
Right.
The resident has changed drastically in the last 32 years I've been doing this. It used to be the silent generation, the greatest generation, and their, you know, needs, demands, and wants were totally different than the boomers are. So that's one part of the equation. But the residents' families have changed quite a bit as well. Mm-hmm. They're tech savvy. I just heard a story anecdotally yesterday in one of our communities where a resident was moving into our Naples community. And the reason they felt, which is a brand new community we just built, the reason they felt so confident is because they read all of the reviews from our communities across the country.
Oh, wow.
And they really resonated with what was happening in Marysville, Ohio.
Oh, wow.
That makes a big difference, right? So that customer buy-in is important. It used to be historically, how many cars are going to drive by and see your sign? That's the tours you were going to get that might lead to a movement in deposit.
Yeah, I have a quick question for you as it relates to the resident profile too, since we're talking about that. I think average age historically was 80 to 82, that a person who's aging would move into a community. Is that changing?
Oh, it's changed quite a bit, actually. So, yeah, it coalesces with the disease processes that are out there as well. People are getting sicker younger, right, mm-hmm. and getting more complicated disease. I remember, I believe when I started in this industry, it was about 1 in 6 people at the age of 80 had a dementia diagnosis. Mm-hmm. Now it's closer to 1 in 2, mm-hmm. right?
So and it's even projected to be worse than that in the next sort of 10 years.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a terrifying problem. Right. But yes, people are waiting longer and they're waiting longer and being less healthy when they're moving into this community, mm-hmm. which is something that we're trying to cure. And mm-hmm. it kind of goes back to Mike's question around design intent, right? Yeah. Are we designing communities that people would move into if they didn't necessarily need to move into right. today, so yes. they can be proactive? So the resident profile has changed. The prospective resident profile has changed. Mm-hmm. Their family member profile has changed quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And so have our team members. Mm-hmm. They've changed drastically. I mean, mm-hmm. a sense of purpose mm-hmm. and belonging is really critical to our employees. And sure. and right now, it really is about, like it is in most industries, it's about getting the right team members on, mm-hmm. on your team. So if we can build in a better location for them where they have easier access to transportation, they feel part of something different. Our mission is about creating communities with purpose, and they feel that they can have that duality of a good compensated job, but also the purpose of what I'm doing to mm-hmm. take care of my elders.
And doing it in a physical environment where you are excited to be.
That's exactly right.
Thrive.
There's not fluorescent lighting. There's right. not this smell.
And live alongside the residents that are there to live equally as well.
Absolutely. Right. So yeah. when you speak of it better than anybody, when you see this huge funnel of people that are coming into the aging process of turning 80 or turning 65, and the demographics are just terrifying to be able to meet as a country, let alone as a developer, you just go, what are we going to do? Mm-hmm. And so you look at these old existing assets that just are not attractive to people. And we want to move down that funnel, make sure that we're getting, you know, kind of younger people that are self-selecting and are happy about their decision and are telling their friends because they're living longer, healthier lives because they live in our community.
So from an investment perspective, we're talking about, obviously, and we've been having a discussion about, again, the strong demographic tailwinds that are there. But it also is sounding like the pool, the resident pool that we are pulling from, yes. Is aging down,
yes.
I would say,
yes.
which creates greater opportunity for us yes. and investors and solving and serving a greater need.
Yes.
And so not only is a larger pool aging down, we're talking about when done well from an environment and operational perspective and alignment of capital, a longer stay in these communities, these homes.
No question.
Good for everybody.
That's exactly what we're seeing. Yeah. People moving in healthier, younger, staying longer and happier through the entire process, which is causing more demand.
Right.
Right. People are saying, oh my gosh, if I don't take advantage of moving into this great community that I want with the 2-bedroom, with the view of the park, which is exactly what I want, mm-hmm. somebody else gets it, I might not have an opportunity right. for 6 years.
Right. That's interesting. So if I were to take what I would characterize as the typical investor mindset and perspective, again, because one of the sort of common dialogues we engage in is, so even in the face of the inevitability of these demographics, in the strength of the opportunity, right? As you look at it in the abstract,
yes,
it's less that it's the skeptic in me, i.e. the capital mm-hmm. representative, it's less about it being skeptical and more about, you know, just, you know, classic Harry Truman, you know, show me.
Yes.
So if I take that perspective and say, you know, well, these communities don't sell themselves.
Of course.
And so when you think about just the attractiveness and the demand creation around this new thing, if you will, and JD's point around the facilitation of an age-in-place environment and a longer stay, how do you fill mm-hmm. these buildings, right? Because yes. that there's still a speculative component to the
Absolutely.
Real estate
of
that
course.
Then leads into the ops.
Yes.
And then if residents are staying longer, there is the logical question of like, you know, from an affordability standpoint and a cost standpoint. So
yes.
can you speak to I hate asking two questions that are completely different, but sure. You have two questions in front of you that I'd love to get your perspective.
Yeah, you know, it always does come down for us of people taking care of people and building trust, right? And our brand as a company is about trust and building better outcomes for our residents, families, team members, our investors, and everybody in line. So when we go into a market, I think, you know, rather than just kind of build across the country, because we are a national developer and just stamp out properties that are the exact same look, feel, and operation, which others have done and done successfully. You know, we feel like we want to be part of the culture of the community when we come in. So I'm sure you and Christoph talked about this when he was on the show. But we really spend a lot of time up front understanding the market that we're going into, not only from a data and demographic perspective, but what is important to the prospective residents that we think that we're going to attract. What is their lifestyle like? What are their creature comforts, right? Because mm-hmm. moving out of your home is a big deal. Mm-hmm, right. And this is a big step, and we don't take that lightly. We want to make sure that as much of our residents' lives that they've been experienced their whole lives translates to our community. So from a design perspective, we spend so much time thinking about each space and how is it going to feel and look to the residents. Is it part of their clubs? Is it their favorite restaurants that they go to? What does it feel like? So that's a piece of it. And then we build the culture really as soon as we break ground. We really invest a lot of money and time into having our team be in the market, educating the market on what we're trying to do and learning from the market and what's important to them operationally, so that the physical plant is one thing, but the lifestyle and the community that's connected in the community and how our residents make a difference outside of the community and still retain that value and purpose in their life is met every single day.
It's interesting because Steve Christoph, you know, when he was speaking to the design element, you know, I asked him a very similar question, like, how do you reconcile, you know, this need to be innovative and creative on design with sort of the cost component? And genuinely, he came back in a very similar way that you just did. He's like, you know, intelligent, intentional design doesn't have to cost more.
It doesn't, right.
And when I hear you, I can't help but smile and be proud because I think what I hear you saying is it doesn't cost anything to listen.
No.
And to understand. And again, it's a differentiator between the healthcare space and other asset classes like multifamily, yes. which is like, I'm just going to look at the data. I'm going to analyze a spreadsheet. And where is the spreadsheet telling me is the next most sort of viable market to sort of put my commoditized product in? I'm going to go and I'm going to build something that is sort of designed moderately consistent with whatever is working in market. I'm going to plant that flag and then I'm going to move on.
Yes.
Without any effort to understand, is this really what the market wants?
Right.
And so I love to hear that because to your point, it's like we are embedding ourselves into that community. And so it is incumbent upon us to take the time to be a part of that.
Yeah, I've had the benefit of touring some of our communities with existing residents, prospective residents, and there is something that is going on that is resulting in the outcomes we're talking about here.
Yeah.
It is rewarding to hear a resident say, wow, this is my forever home.
Yes. Yeah.
And
well, it's funny because I want you to finish that story because we've had similar reactions from capital.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And when they see the manifestation of that listening, and they understand that there is no sort of like direct correlative impact to the cost basis.
Yes.
Like they feel it too and they've had similar reactions.
They have. Yeah. And again, I'm biased. However, I think that outcome is produced by this integrated model that we've been discussing.
No question.
Which is when you have experienced senior living, at the table with the developer, with the understanding of what the investor is looking for, what the market needs, with the right design team in place and the overall project team in place, you have a shot at producing these outcomes. But the proof's only in the pudding when you actually have the residents that show up or the team members that show up because you want to retain staff and you want to retain residents and you want to create this different experience.
Right.
And to hear people talk about it when they see it and they touch it and they feel it and they smell it and it doesn't smell like they used to.
No.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, it's a person-centered approach, and yeah. we always talk about person-centered healthcare as a nation. I'm not sure it happens well in our healthcare.
Some do it better than
others, right? Right. But when we actually go to design these buildings, we are thinking about who we think will be in these communities, and then as we get to know those residents, it evolves organically, right?
Right.
So our design evolves, our operations evolve. We get asked this question all the time: what's going to be on the activities calendar when I move in? And we always say, let's do it together. Let's co-create, right? I want to know what's important to you. Yeah. You know, you don't walk in our communities and see bingo 24/7, but that was the older school senior housing.
Sorry, Mike, you're up.
Yes. Yeah, I mean. but to me, just understanding our residents' needs, wants, and desires really helps to define, you know, kind of what is culture going to look and feel like in these communities. And I think that person-centered approach, I know that person-centered approach translates into happier, healthier residents, because they don't feel like I'm apartment 102.
Sure.
They are Mr. and Mrs. Johnson, or whoever they are, and feel a part of it. And that purpose is critical, because they feel a part of the outcome as well.
Yeah.
That's great.
So getting back to the second part of my run-on question, because it's a massive, you know, elephant in the room of any sort of capital conversation, because when the difference between the then and now is as dramatic as it can be, right? When you talk about certainly the types of communities that we and you know, others in our peer group are delivering into the market, again, to satisfy this sort of evolving sort of customer need and expectation. But when that difference is so dramatic, the natural instinct is to sort of default to like, well, that just must cost an arm and a leg. And like, how is that economically viable and feasible and things like that? So less so from an investor perspective, because I have found this incredibly helpful as you know, I've moved into the space and gotten more comfortable and familiar with how it works. But can you speak to the sort of just basic economics, the resident economics of a senior living experience in a community? And just to give you some further context, when we're talking about the design, you know, we were sort of mentioning difference between traditional multi and seniors, right? Mm-hmm. So approximately 30% of the community in a senior community is dedicated to common areas.
Yes.
You have to provide a commercial kitchen
and those
kinds of things. And so understandably, that's going to contribute to some differential in economics. But it's a lot more than that.
Yes.
So you do it better than anyone I know. So I want to give you that opportunity.
I appreciate that. I mean, where my mind goes to when the question is kind of our maniacal sense of around design and urgency about how to build these and design these communities. So for us, you know, I've worked with other companies and again, some great companies in senior living, but they're just not as fanatical about the resident experiences as we are, or the design of the buildings. And it really does start with that from an economic perspective. A lot will just hire an architect that's designed, you know, I've done 5,000 of these communities, and you guys don't even have to show up to the meetings. Just, you know, pay me my fee and we'll design the building for you. That's not how we operate at all, right? So we are well into all of the design meetings, into the details on the drawings, and making sure that, you know, we're getting the looks we want for the most economical outcome that we could possibly have. So, and I'll give you a perfect example. We had an architect who will remain nameless that designed, you know, a system for us, and we go in and, you know, there was a $40,000 light switch, right? It just made no sense for us to control our lighting that way. It was not required by code. There was no benefit to the resident.
And the resident sure is not going to pay rent that correlates to that increase.
No value. No question. But if we had chosen to go down that path with that architect, what $40,000 piece of what would have had to come out of the community? That would have probably been a whole amenity space, right? And so that, to me, the resident-facing things that matter to the residents are really important, that they look, feel, and touch exactly like we want our residents to experience. But that light switch was not that critical. So multiply that times a 400,000-foot building, and you can imagine where this could go. So being that intentional about how we design the buildings, that's really where it starts. And then also meeting kind of the market where it's at. So understanding, again, what are the housing, you know, requirements in the area? What are people, you know, buying, and what's important to them? In some areas, if you don't have the highest end appliances, people are not going to move in. In some areas, it really is not that critical, right? So that's important to us.
And these are also cost items that are certainly and admittedly incremental, but not sort of so material that it skews it into an economically unfeasible prospect.
Correct.
And I think that's the thing that I want listeners and investors to sort of take away, is that this combination of listening and intentionality around the built environment translates into value,
huge value
for the resident in terms of the space rent, the community rent, and then the care component of the overall cost associated with their residency.
Right.
All of which is commensurate with the existing product in the market. And
yes.
So for the resident, it is massive bang for their buck. And in return, there is tremendous intrinsic value to the investor.
No question. I mean, you might see communities that are on the market that might be 20 or 30% cheaper than ours that are, you know, 50, 60% occupied. And we build a new build down the street and you say, well, what's the better value, right? Well, some of those communities, no one would ever want to live in. They never choose to move into. So
that's my favorite thing that you often do, which is, you know, even ask peer groups on, you know, industry panels and things like that. It's like, which of your communities would you actually, you know, reside in?
Well, if you didn't have to,
if you didn't have to,
that's the key. And so I'd say the same with our investors or any of our, any of my peers. If you didn't have a medical or physical need to move in, which would you choose to give up your house, your lifestyle to move into?
Yeah.
Right.
We are building communities that I would gladly move into without any physical or medical needs.
Yeah, likewise. So I think that's a really good, I mean, you and I always enjoy our conversations.
Likewise.
And it's, you know, we've closed down a few places.
Yes, we have.
Having these conversations. But, you know, I want to transition to, you know, a fun part of, you know, our segment. So,
sure.
You know, JD and I like to, you know, at the end of these episodes, put ourselves in the shoes of our listeners and our,
yes.
you know, prospective investors and sort of take into account all of the things that we discussed and then look at each other and say, what's your move?
Yeah.
So, Phil, what's your move?
You know, it's interesting. I'm obviously biased as well. I really believe in numbers and data, and the demographics are a very compelling story. And I think there's a lot of different ways to invest in healthcare, and especially in senior housing. You can go, you know, the big REIT plot play, or you can go direct investments with developers like ours. And my thesis would always be around, well, what's your plan? As a developer, when you're putting your capital in something, I want to know what the plan is to reach your potential clients, right? And so for me, our very specific approach of like just targeting the markets that we feel have older product that, you know, aren't very good product, but have high occupancy and high rate, and bringing in a new product and being specific to that market makes a lot of sense. The way that we take care of our team members makes a lot of sense. So you get that risk of the operating business off the table, because we really do a great job investing in our employees and having that vertical integration. So for me, I'm very, very bullish on senior housing, clearly.
Yeah.
I would do it very specifically and targeted on, you know, who's got the best plan for the best outcomes.
Yeah. Love it. JD, what's your move?
Given the structural change that's going on in the industry, I think the smart investor has seniors as part of their portfolio.
No question.
100%. And I think, you know, my move can be summed up as I typically do in a very sort of colloquial way. What got us here won't get us there. Yeah. Things are changing.
That's great.
And if you aren't identifying the groups that are doing the things that are being most responsive to the market, you're going to get left behind.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly right.
And with that,
it's a wrap.
I think we have a wrap. Tortilla.
Thanks for listening to The Move, a show exploring what's shaping the future of healthcare real estate. If you liked what you heard, follow the show and share with someone you know looking to make their next move.